Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the NATO Association of Canada podcast on changes in the global economy. Last time we discussed the idea of openness in the global economy, openness of borders, ideas, trade, people, etc., and the legitimacy of the liberal world economic order. You can find a link to that podcast in the text below. How about we move to the second topic, which is social factors of change? That would be things like innovations, demographics, new industries popping up, restructuring institutions. Go ahead, Nilam.
Yeah, so I'll touch a little bit upon the way innovation is really changing the global economic order. And I kind of want to just talk about a really interesting article I read in McKinsey Quarterly, which was published in 2016. And it really defines innovation occurring in two separate ways. And I'll give an example of both and then see if you guys have anything to add. So there's two ways that innovation generally has been occurring. And one is to realign markets. So uncover demand that you didn't know existed, as well as just create a supply. And so an example of this is Spotify. So whereas consumers are used to having to perhaps purchase an album or a CD, for those who just want like a single song or two songs off an album, they had to either buy the CD or just not buy music, whereas Spotify really gives you the chance, Apple Music as well, to like buy single songs. So you're creating this supply, but you're also uncovering this demand that you didn't know existed. And so it's kind of creating more of a perfection between the supply and demand curve. And then there's another one, which is much more disruptive, which is to give customers or consumers something they didn't even know they wanted, and creating supply and demand where you didn't know it existed. And the example I'm going to use here is WeChat. Now, WeChat has been compared to Facebook, WhatsApp. It started off as a messenger app. And a lot of people, if we're using WhatsApp, we are not really thinking, can I book a flight? But what WeChat does is it's not only your messenger app, it can be your travel agent, it can be your resume, it can be a video chat service. It's your banking machine. So when you're opening your social media chat service, you're not thinking about all these other industries as well. But this disruption that we've seen with WeChat is that it's uncovering a sense, it's uncovering something that consumers didn't even know they wanted. And now they perform more monthly transactions using their WeChat account than an American does per month using plastic, which is their debit or their MasterCard or Visa or anything. So it's really tapped into a market that consumers, even in North America, I don't think really know exists. So, and it's really, and China's really kind of got the ball rolling with this, and it's really uncovered this cashless economy that North America has yet to kind of tap into. So I really see a huge shift with the economy in that sense.
Wow. I didn't know that actually about WeChat. Ross, you wanted to add.
Yeah. Yeah, your points, Nilan, were really interesting. They made me think of something, particularly your point on Spotify. The subscription model is increasingly important in economies all over the world, and it's something that has spread far beyond music streaming services, something that's spread far beyond the kind of cloud services that we're used to using and that traditional models have struggled to move to. I used to work in the transit sector. And one of the things that I found especially fascinating is watching the subscription model move into very physical, very real and substantial parts of our economies. In Finland, for example, there's an organization called Mass Global, which has created an app called WIM, which links together various transit services in Finland, biking, heavy rail, light rail, car sharing, and all of these services can be accessed via a subscription. So rather than purchasing a transit pass or a typical means of accessing local transit services, instead you purchase a subscription and you link together a series of packages that will enable you to manage your daily commute. So instead of paying $100 for a metro pass, you purchase a subscription that you then tailor to your personal needs. And it really fits into this sort of individualized model that we're seeing increasingly, where people want economic systems that are tailored to their very specific needs. But it's not only possible to do that in the digital economy, it's also entirely possible to do that in the physical world.
Right.
Yeah.
And so you have a kind of blurring of the line between the digital and the physical then, right?
Well, you have a genuine shift in the way that economic models are being generated. We have have economic models really being tailored to the level of the individual consumers with the kinds of services that were previously never possible to calibrate to that scale.
Right. Megan, you wanted to add? Meg.
Well, right. So it's interesting, kind of this whole shift to, you know, intangible trade, really. It's not so much focused on trading, you know, hard resources. That still, of course, exists. But there is a huge shift to the online world and things that you, you know, can't physically trade. So in that sense, yeah, there in the future, hypothetically, there could be no one place that, you know, holds the power of global political economy. It could be just, well, it's kind of unknown territory. Mm-hmm. It's not whoever has the most trees anymore, or, you know, it's whoever can think up the best ideas now.
So does that mean that we're going to have a profound shift to a more knowledge-based economy then?
I think for sure. I think especially with technology going towards driverless cars and automated jobs, or, you know, jobs taking up being taken up by robots and things like that, it's already, you're already seeing it. You know, it is a knowledge-based economy, and it's definitely going to go that way, I think, in the future.
Mm-hmm. Brad?
Yeah, so on that point, it got me thinking about how we hear this term thrown around, knowledge economy, but then if we really reflect on what that means, it's kind of frightening in a way. I mean, like some people may recall just a month or two ago, there was a pretty big decision in the United States that allowed, internet providers to sell our metadata, online metadata, to third parties, right? And I mean, the point of mass media has always been to sell people's attention to advertisers so that they can sell us their products. That's where the revenue comes from in Hollywood, in pro sports, in pretty much everything you can think of. But now it's becoming even easier in the era of big data, where they can, like you guys were saying, they can tailor the avenues by which they capture our attention and create profiles on different cohorts and demographics of people to better, I guess, isolate what we want and how to sell it to us. And there are, again, implications for privacy, and the Internet of Things is going to make that more pervasive in our lives too, because you can't really escape where you're being tracked. I mean, and this will be to our benefit in many ways, the way you could have like a home assistant, Alexa or Siri or whatever, and it'll be integrated into the vehicle you drive. And so you have everything is harmonized between your workplace and your house and your smartphone. It does everything for you. It's a luxury for us, but the cost of that, if you want to say the
risk,
right? We don't know
the cybersecurity risk, right?
We don't know how much is too much in terms of giving up our. And people say, oh, they have our data, and people are like, well, that doesn't matter. It's just I want the product they're selling, but little do we realize down the road we might be kicking ourselves for surrendering so much so naively, you know?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. So what I'm noticing is that there's a really interesting bifurcation here, where on the one hand you have a system that is designed to be more tailored to individual needs, and the subscription-based models that are popping up everywhere seem to be giving more power to consumers to choose what they want to receive. But on the other hand, you have less power over that process, less power over the process by which those developments occur, as more of our data, more of our personal lives are kind of, to be cynical a little bit, intruded upon. You have really interesting dynamic where you have more choice, but perhaps less power, or more power, but less choice.
Well, I think the question, or the chief problem that Brad, you were touching on, Phil, that you've very professionally identified, is the purpose to which data is being harnessed. And ultimately, this data is being harnessed for private interests. That's one of the great differences between the way that data has been collected and used in the past and the way that it is now largely being mobilized, is that data collection is now happening on a mass commercialized scale in a way that it never happened before. Mm-hmm. There's a fascinating piece in The Guardian about the science of statistics and how it was originally harnessed to the needs of the state, hence the name. And although there are myriad problems with the way that states have collected and used data, there are well-developed avenues to addressing the misuse of information by the public, and there has always been an important principle of transparency about the use of that information. Those principles and safeguards do not exist in the private industry and the way that private firms use our information. So the challenge is not only one that we are being sold very well-tailored packages that appear to give choice, but are in fact nonetheless tailored by private industries, but more importantly, that data is being collected in the name of serving the customer, but really it is being collected and finessed in order to develop private profits.
Right.
And so the interests involved in this knowledge economy are much murkier, much harder to unravel, and ultimately much less about the public interest than data in the past. And that, I think, is the challenge that you guys have been getting at.
That's really interesting. So private interests use data about us for us. We are almost feeding them the capital that they need to create this product that's tailored to us. In a sense, the capital is ourselves. That can have profound
We help industries build niche products that they then sell to us. And it gives us a sense of choice. But we forget who holds all the power to create that product and offer us the choice.
Yeah.
That's a very reflective way of looking at it.
Yeah. So I was just during the conversation on the way data analytics are kind of gathered and used to tailor products for the consumers to what they want and then packaging them in an individual way for the person. It reminded me of the way society has really shifted. The world has really shifted in a very consumer-centric way. So, and I'm thinking of the recent United Airlines example of the video that went viral of the man being dragged out of the airplane and just how much backlash the airline received. It lost close to $1 billion in shareholder value. And so this is a real implication for a very large corporation. It just shows how companies can't really get away with these things anymore, and that they are, and that consumers do hold power in these situations. But going further than that, I think if you dig a little deeper, and then this is where I was reflecting on a lot of the points you made. I read recently that the reason when you walk into a supermarket and the produce is in the right in the front is because they want you to buy the produce first so you feel less guilty about buying all the sugary, all the salty, all the processed food after. And
figures.
All supermarkets are set up in this way. So just building on your points, I think while capitalism or whatever is touted as being consumer-centric now, as being for the individual, I feel that it's more of a telling the individual, like creating the individual, telling them more what they are, because yes, you're gathering data to find what the consumers want and then packaging their goods in a way to purchase them from you. But it's also about almost commodifying emotions and shifting and drawing upon emotions in a way to produce value for the corporations. And it was just this example that got me thinking about whether in fact it's very much played up in a way that it is a consumer-centric kind of age that we live in, or whether it's more of a an illusion over just kind of creating what the consumer wants, in a sense.
That's really interesting. Thank you all so much for your contributions. In the next part of our podcast, we're going to talk about geopolitical events and trends, how different countries' political inclinations and actions on the global stage affect our economic future. So thanks everybody for listening, and stay tuned for more.